He's a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and has been a critic of the system. He has a number of ideas on welfare reform, and we will talk about that in this part of Focus 580. As is the case always, we're interested in your comments and your questions. We think you will perhaps want to react to what the guest has to say or pose some questions for him to answer, and we welcome that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. And anywhere else you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Rector, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. Let's begin by having you talk about the problems that you see with the welfare system as it is now. What is wrong with it?
Well, one thing that's not wrong with it is a lack of money, a lack of spending. Federal, state, and local governments spend in 1990, the last year for which we have data, $226 billion on welfare assistance, and by that I mean programs that are exclusively targeted to low-income persons, and I'm not counting programs for the middle class, such as student loans or social security. Total welfare spending in constant 1990 dollars since the war on poverty began in the mid-1960s has been $3.5 trillion. Adjusting for inflation, that's greater than the cost of fighting World War II. And, of course, in World War II, we won. It seems rather dubious whether we can claim victory in the war on poverty. Total overall spending on welfare in inflation-adjusted terms has increased fivefold since the war on poverty began. So there's a tremendous amount of resources that we've been putting out there to assist the poor. I think the real problem is that these resources have been misdirected and, in fact, have generated more problems than they have solved. I think that to begin to talk about reforming the welfare system, it's important to distinguish between two different types of poverty. The first is simple material poverty, and by material poverty, what I mean by that is what the ordinary citizen thinks about as poverty, that is, a person who cannot feed his family nutritious food or who lacks a reasonably warm and dry shelter to keep a family in, or in an even simpler sense, a family that perhaps has an income less than the official poverty threshold, which is about $14,000 a year for a family of four, although I would point out that many families can be adequately fed and housed for less funds than that. The second type of poverty is more complicated and I think is a much more important issue. And that has been termed by Senator Moynihan from New York behavioral poverty. And by behavioral poverty, we talk about a cluster of behaviors such as out-of-wedlock births, divorce, prolonged single parenthood, long-term welfare dependence, eroded work ethic, lack of educational attainment and aspiration, and inability to discipline and motivate one's children, criminal behavior, drug abuse, and a lot of other social behaviors like that. And what we have seen, coincident with this tremendous increase in spending in the war on poverty, is a great increase in welfare dependence and in these type of behavioral poverty problems. And what we need is to recognize that most of the problem is that the spending that we have put into conventional welfare programs has in fact caused an increase in behavioral poverty. If we're simply talking about material poverty, I would disagree with most liberals in the sense that I think the government has done a reasonably efficient job of giving away food and housing and cash and so forth, so that if you really look below the surface in the sensational political claims, what you can see is that there are very, very few poor people left in the United States that do not have reasonably decent housing, that do not have nutritious food to eat and so forth. If I could show to your audience, which unfortunately I can't, a chart prepared, which has been done many times by the Agriculture Department, comparing the average consumption of protein, minerals, and vitamins of very poor children and comparing that against upper-middle-class children. You would not really be able to tell the difference, and in fact, they consume, in most cases, well over the recommended daily allowance of almost all nutrients. Poor children, for example, on average, consume 100% above the recommended daily allowance of protein, which is a very expensive nutriment. Same thing for most other vitamins and minerals. You can't really tell the difference between lower-income children and upper-income children. And as a consequence of that, we find the paradoxical thing that poor children, when they grow up to and reach age 18 today, in fact grow up to be 1 inch taller and 10 pounds heavier than the GIs who stormed the beaches of Normandy in World War II. It's pretty hard to do that if you're consistently hungry and malnourished, as some political figures would claim. And I think that failing to recognize that we have pretty adequately addressed this problem of material poverty really distracts us from the more central problem, which is this huge proliferation of growth of behavioral poverty. When the war on poverty began in the 1960s, one out of four black children in the United States was born out of wedlock. Today, the figure is two out of three. That is a real figure, and there's a tremendous amount of human tragedy involved in that figure. The children who grow up without father figures are much more likely to fail in school. They will have more medical problems. They have many more emotional problems, and they're dramatically more likely to be involved in crime and other activities like that. So that, and also this problem is not restricted to black children. The same increase in illegitimacy is occurring among low-income whites. So that is a huge social problem that we must begin to address. Now, my feeling is that the problems of behavioral poverty that we are seeing are not solely, but largely a result of the fact that all of this conventional welfare spending that we're doing, this $226 billion a year, comes in the form of programs that reward self-destructive behavior. And that's the core issue in terms of reforming welfare. To put the whole thing in a nutshell, basically, we provide a mother with two unwed children that she's had out of wedlock, on average in the United States, a welfare paycheck from various programs worth about $14,000 a year. I call that the paycheck. Now, there are two conditions that society insists on very firmly for that mother to be able to earn that welfare paycheck. One is she can't work, and the other is she cannot marry a fully employed male. If she does either of those two things, the welfare state will either cut off almost all of her welfare payments or dramatically reduce them. And it's what I call the incentive system from hell. If you wanted to design a system that was had a greater potential for capturing people in dependency and for discouraging marriage and encouraging single mothers to remain on welfare and not become part of a stable, married, two-parent family, you couldn't come up with a worse system than what we've got. And I think what we need to begin to do is change the incentive structure in all of these welfare programs so that we reduce the rewards that we're providing to non-work and non-marriage, and we increase the rewards to work and marriage. Once we begin to do that, then I think we will begin not only to address the problems of material poverty, but also to begin to address these behavioral poverty problems and to really improve the quality of life of low-income people.
Let me reintroduce our guest, and then we'll take a call from somebody who is listening. Our guest this morning, Robert Rector, is a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. We're talking about welfare, the system as it exists, what may be wrong with it, what may be right with it, how it may be changed. And we welcome your comments. We do have one caller here on our toll-free line we'll get right to, and would welcome anybody else into the program locally, 333-WILL. That's the number to call. We also have the toll-free line. You can use it anywhere you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, those other states where the signal travels, and that number is 800-222-9455. Here is our caller on the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got a comment and then a question. And the comment has to do you sort of talked about it in talking about your disincentives, but disincentives that got me thinking was there was a girl whose mother was on welfare, and the little girl was saving up money for college, and she evidently made more than $1,000 or whatever. So they, what they did was they took money from her mother, which when I first heard it, I said, boy, look at them welfare cheats, and I was kind of mad at the girl. And then, you know, I got to thinking about it, and I said, geez, I'm a capitalist and this and that. I said, that's terrible. Maybe it might be fair to say, you know, take away money from radio guys that have talk shows. If their children make too much money, then he has to give the money back to the company or whatever. But for anybody else, it seems ridiculous. It seems ridiculous for everybody. But I was just being facetious. So when I got to thinking about it, I said, how can we correct this problem? And the only way I could think of is to, since we can't elect all the state representatives, perhaps have a governor who will pardon every welfare cheat. And that seems to make sense to me, in that would flood the system and do away with welfare altogether.
Well, I think that what the problem you're talking about is a symptom of a larger problem. Despite what Secretary Jack Kemp says about this young woman who was ostensibly saving for her college education, that family almost certainly was cheating on welfare. They did have earnings that they weren't reporting, and they were putting those in the bank. And in fact, that's a very common thing on welfare. The problem, and that's why we have asset tests on welfare, so that if you're getting welfare and you're piling up money in the bank, somebody suspects there's something wrong, and you restrict that. But that's only a small symptom of the more fundamental problem, which is that the welfare system says to the mother, if you don't work, then we're going to give you $14,000 a year. If you work, or if your daughter works, or if your boyfriend is working and you marry him, then we're going to cut down your welfare payments really almost by a $1 reduction for every dollar of earnings that you have. And that is what creates the very strong incentive system for these welfare mothers to go out and work or have their daughter work, but not report to anybody that you're doing that. Now there would be so the basic thing is the way that welfare works is you get a certain amount of money if you're not married and not working. And then if you get married or if you work, you're going to have those welfare benefits scaled back dramatically. Now there would be sort of two ways of addressing that. One would be to say, oh, okay, you can go ahead and work or you can go ahead and get married to an employed man and we won't reduce your welfare benefits. The problem with that is that you just made almost a tremendous segment of the American population immediately eligible for welfare because you're saying, well, we don't care what your earned income is or what your husband's income is. We're going to give you a lot of welfare benefits anyway. That would cost hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, and it simply couldn't be afforded. The other way to begin to change this incentive structure would be to say, to at least some of the mothers on welfare, okay, we're giving you assistance. We're giving you assistance worth $14,000 a year. We believe that we need to assist you and we need to help you support your family. However, welfare should not be a one-way handout. What it should be is that we will assist you and we will expect you to do something back in return. We'll expect you either to get a private sector job or if you can't find one, we will ask you to perform community service in exchange for the assistance that we're giving you. Now, all of a sudden, you've dramatically changed that mother's incentive system because she no longer is getting a free income from the government. She now has to perform some service in exchange for getting that income, and that has two very positive side effects. One is it makes it much more attractive for her to get a real private sector job. If she has to now work in exchange for the $14,000 a year we're giving her in welfare benefits, now it makes it much more attractive for her to say, well, if I'm going to have to work for this welfare, maybe I should go get a private sector job where I'll have greater personal dignity, maybe a slightly higher income, and so forth. So it makes real work in the private sector more attractive to her. It also makes it more attractive for her to get married because if she marries an employed male, she will still lose eligibility for those welfare benefits, but she's losing eligibility for something that she has to now earn. And if she can get a job that pays roughly the same amount, then the marriage no longer serves to reduce her overall income.
Right, and if you believe in the goodness of government, or that government has a reason to be in that area, then you might believe that will work. If you believe government works, then you would believe that program might work.
Well, I believe that this sort of transcends government, and that this is, in fact, what we're talking about here are the basic rules of human charity. The Apostle
Paul says...
Of course,
when you government for... Is that what you're saying? Of course, when you government for charity?
No, I'm saying that, in fact, even if the charity were totally private sector, or, say, totally within a church, we would still want to follow these same rules. The rules transcend whether or not it's a government or a non-government that's giving out the aid.
You're saying government, in the New Testament, because they're the best suited to do it? They've got the most money, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that we know certain laws of how to assist people and how not to assist people. And we know that whoever is giving out the money, that if it is given out as a one-way handout, it is neither good for the giver nor for the recipient. The Apostle Paul says in the New Testament, he who shall not work shall not eat. And I think it's very important when thinking about welfare to add, and that was in fact the foundation of Judeo-Christian charity through most of the history of this country. In fact, religious charities in the 19th and early 20th century all used that maxim. And the question to ask is, why did they do that? Was it because they had a fiscal crunch and they didn't have enough money to spend? Or was it because they were secretly supporters of Ronald Reagan and supply-side economics? I think not. I think that what the Christian charities, the Jewish charities, recognized was that if you give aid unconditionally without requiring anything from the recipient in return, that you create a sort of unlimited demand for assistance, which is what we've seen in the United States for the last 20 years. Secondly, if you give unconditionally without expecting anything in return, you undermine the self-capacity of the recipient. You make them accustomed to being dependent. You make them accustomed to living without marriage. You make them accustomed and comfortable with being basically a drag on everyone else, and that in the long term is a very harmful thing to do to the recipient. Instead of that, what we need is an aid system based on mutual responsibility. We will assist, but we expect positive and responsible behavior from the recipient back in return for what we give.
You've essentially convinced me on just about all of that. But now what I want to ask you a question on something that's kind of different, but yet it seems where you and the feminists tend to agree, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like Dan Quayle and the feminists want some sort of federal system to capture deadbeat parents or their money or something like that, is the way I'm reading them. And to me, that's blatantly unconstitutional the way I see it. Unless we're going to have federal laws that will mandate marriage, divorce, alimony, child support, property arrangements, you know, that type of deal. If the federal government's going to do that, then it would be okay to start enforcing those. But if a state's doing that, say New Jersey allows all kinds of homosexual marriages and this and that, and then one of them comes to New Jersey owing the other one $10,000 a month, why should Illinois agree to have this guy pay $10,000 a month to his boyfriend in New Jersey?
That isn't really the case that we're dealing with. What we're dealing with here are some 4 million single mothers on AFDC, many of whom have boyfriends who have jobs and could pay something to contribute to the support of that child, but are not...
I've got money, too, that could contribute. But
well, in fact, you are contributing. You're contributing as a taxpayer, whereas the real biological parent of the child is not contributing. So the general principle on which I think there's a large amount of agreement is as follows. that in the future we should reform the welfare system so that a mother who has a child out of wedlock, as a condition of receiving welfare benefits, must positively cooperate in establishing who the father is. There are biological tests now that we have using DNA structure and so forth that can very reliably indicate who the father is. Once you've established who the father is, the father must be expected to contribute something to the maintenance of that child as long as the child is a minor. And if the and in my mind, if the father says, well, I don't have a job, I can't pay, I can't do this, then you would say, okay, to the father, you say that you can't find work, well, then we're going to bring you down here and you're going to perform community service to help pay off this obligation that that you have to support this child, rather than expecting the general taxpayer to support this child. When this has been tried by Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin and some other states, suddenly this absent father finds a job and is able to pay his child support payment. So this is really a question of expecting absent fathers to make a contribution to defer welfare costs. And I think that by not giving the father a free ride, by saying that you're not going to be able to go around and have four, five, or six children out of wedlock and boast to everyone in the community about your powers as a male, but and have no responsibility for those children, from here on in, you're going to have financial responsibility for these children. I think that that would have a dramatic effect in terms of changing behavior. Now, whether or not you would do this at the federal government level or simply encourage states to undertake this type of reform is, I think, another issue and really a rather technical one. Because it is a federal program, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, that we're talking about here. And one of the problems also that does require a federal role is that many of these fathers do jump from one state to another in order to avoid the child support payments that they owe back in their original state. And that absolutely does require some federal role of enforcement and trying to prevent fathers from basically skipping the state in order to evade their responsibilities.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Robert Rector. He is a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the welfare system and welfare reform, and would be happy to have your questions. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. We have some other callers standing by here, so let's go on, and we'll talk with someone on line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning, David. Since I called into the first show, I'll be really brief. But these two-parters I really like. I really enjoy them. Mr. Rector, I just want to tell you, oh, wonderful, good. I agree with just about everything you say. And it's great to hear it. I actually called for a couple points of view, and you might be able to help me. I've argued for a long time, but I'm not sure that I'm on good footing, historical footing. I've never bothered to look it up, and I thought you might be the person to answer it. And then, David, I have one very quick follow-up question after this. This insanity that you mentioned about the woman can't be married, there can't be income, et cetera, does that derive... I've argued with my friends that I said, look, when these welfare things were invented 50, 60 some years ago, whatever it was, back, I think, in the 30s, but I could be slightly wrong about that, I think most people had... I think the rationale probably was this. Gee, everybody wants to work. Getting on the government dole is really a stigma. No one's going to want to stay on it, so we don't have to, you know, we don't have to enforce this because no one's going to want to stay on it. Am I correct about that? That was the original thinking?
No, not quite. The Aid to Families with Dependent Children was created in 1934 in the mm-hmm. middle of the Great Recession, the Great Depression.
Right.
Most of the welfare that was given out at that time was, in fact, workfare. It was programs like the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Project Administration. In fact, around 32, 33, there was a brief flirtation with welfare as we now have it, in the sense that the government gave a lot of money, simply gave money to people, and that was extremely unpopular. It was unpopular both with the recipient and with the general public. So FDR very quickly changed that and moved to work-only assistance. You had to work in order to get assistance.
And we certainly have gotten away from that principle.
Well, then answer me this.
Well, wait.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now, aid to families with dependent children, however, was different. It was a program oriented toward widows who were not expected to work to support their children.
Oh, I see.
And accidentally, this program included in it a provision that did sort of enable unwed mothers also to get assistance, although that was never intended. And Frances Perkins, who was Secretary of Labor at that time, said later that she never even understood that it made unwed mothers eligible. If it had been clear at that time, most people would have said, this is a disaster. You do not want to subsidize this. And as a program for widows, it did not expect people to work. It was a very small amount of money that was given. And it was only in the mid to late 1950s where this program gradually began to be transformed from a program for widows, who there are very few widows in it now, into a program that was basically rewarding unwed mothers or women who were divorced and rewarding them for not working and not marrying. And so it largely is a sort of huge historical accident that the program grew the way it did, and it is, in fact, a very unpopular program. The benefits under the program have not kept up with inflation for the last 20 years. That has nothing to do with Ronald Reagan and the mean, cruel Republicans. That is, in fact, the benefit levels are set by state legislators in every state, and most of these legislatures are controlled by Democrats. They have not increased the spending in this program because they perceive it as having precisely the sort of counterproductive social effects that I've been talking about earlier.
Wow. Well, listen, I'll get to my follow-up question, but thanks a lot, because I had always wondered, again, I'd never really gone to the library to look it up, but I couldn't figure out how such an insane program could have gotten started, but that explains it. My second question is just very hypothetical, and it's simply your own personal view, and I'm just simply curious, because I'm not suggesting this is a practical alternative, but what do you think would happen if we just announced, January 1, 1993, that all welfare is going to be public sector welfare is going to be phased out over 5 years, cut into 20% a year, and that, you know, at the end of 5 years, it's done over, and you know, any charity will, you know, be handled by the private sector. What do you think? I mean, again, this is just hypothetical, and I don't have any dreams that this would become a practical reality, but. You know, any thoughts on something like that and what effect that might have? Anyway, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Okay. I think that would create very huge transition problems, and I think that before you attempted to do that, you would have to undo a lot of the intellectual conditioning that has been done for the past 40 years. Starting in the 1930s and the 1940s and the early 50s, we underwent a very conscious process in which we said that we no longer wanted churches and private institutions to provide charity because, quote, that was demeaning to the poor. I think that's a very pernicious and stupid idea. But basically, we indoctrinated churches and other institutions that they should no longer be the principal mode of providing charity in the United States and that the government would step in instead. I think the government has been a flop. Although I would also say that a lot of private sector charity, since it provides the same sort of unconditional assistance as the government does, isn't much better these days. But if we were to try to go back to a private sector charity system, which I think was in fact a very effective system, given the general low level of economic means that were available, say around 1900 or 1920s, it gave very good assistance. And it gave assistance in a way that I don't think crippled the poor in the sense that the modern welfare state does. But we would have to go through a very prolonged public discussion about why we wanted private sector charity, why we would expect that the private sector should, in fact, resume this role, and so forth. I don't think it could be done in 5 years. In fact, I don't think that this, you know, this type of discussion is even started yet. That's why I concentrate my efforts not on demeaning private sector charity, because I think it was better than what the government gives now, but in simply trying to make sure that the present huge government system we have does the least amount of damage possible, trying to reform that system so that it no longer harms poor people.
Mm. Well, you know, taking what the caller's suggestion, I think some people would say, what you've got to do is you've got to acknowledge that the government is involved in all sorts of activities that one person or another might consider welfare. And that certainly when people think about welfare, generally their minds go to AFDC.
Right.
But after all, people who are married get a deduction for their children, and that's a form of a subsidy. Farmers get subsidies. We're bailing out the SNLs. We bailed out Chrysler. I mean, I think some people might say if you declared an end to welfare, the entire country would grind to a halt if you were fair and acknowledged, you know,
I would make a distinction between allowing someone to keep their own money through a tax deduction and giving someone else's money to someone. I believe that, in fact, we do have a tremendous amount of middle-class welfare through farm subsidies and other programs, and I think that that should be eliminated. But I think we are getting kind of off from the real issue, which is before us, which is to begin to recognize that the welfare system as we currently have it has actually harmed poor people in some respects, and what can we do to begin to transform that system so that harm no longer occurs. I think then in addition to that, we have to talk about some other things that are needed to begin to improve the capacity of poor people to stand on their own 2 feet and become participants in mainstream society. I think that one of those things is crime reduction, is taking a very firm stand on crime. Most people don't realize that the predominant victims of criminals in our society are not rich people. They're poor people. They're poor people that live in the same neighborhoods with the criminals, and they're the ones that are getting mugged and killed. They're the ones that are getting their meager possessions stolen out of their apartments and so forth. So I think that being much firmer on crime and taking repeat criminals off the street will have a disproportionately positive effect on helping poor people. The second thing is educational reform. I'm not a big fan of government monopolies, and what we have to recognize that is, at least in the grade school system in the United States, we do have government monopolies, and the government monopolies are never very good, but usually the people who get the worst service from a government monopoly are those that are at the bottom of the income scale. I think that a very, very positive thing that we can do to help poor people, to help themselves, is to provide them with educational vouchers through choice. There are millions of poor parents in inner cities all across the United States who would like to have the same option that Jesse Jackson as a rich man has, which is that Jesse Jackson sends his kids to a private school. There are millions and millions of poor parents who would like to have a voucher, like to have the option of taking their child out of a public school that can't even protect them from physical assault in the halls, and put that child in a much better quality private sector school or in another public school, and that would have a very positive effect on poor children. One of the things that we do know about poor people today is that, in fact, the strongest social variable in determining whether or not, for example, a young black man will rise up out of poverty and welfare dependence is, in fact, his religious belief and religious practices. Young men in the inner city who have strong religious beliefs are 50% less likely to drop out of high school, 50% less likely to get involved in crime and drug abuse. And I always challenge the Congress of the United States to show me any government program that has one zillionth of that effectiveness in terms of helping the poor to help themselves. So I think another very, very positive thing that we could do in the inner city to change the moral climate in the inner city would be to strengthen the role of churches, and in particular to allow those parents who have strong religious beliefs and to put their children into educational institutions that would reinforce those beliefs. We could give those parents vouchers, and if the parents chose, they wouldn't be forced to, but if the parents chose, they should be able to put their child into a religious school that would reinforce the child's and the parent's own religious conviction. And I think that if we did that, we would see within a decade an absolutely dramatic change in the moral climate in South Los Angeles and in other communities all across the United States.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Robert Rector. He's a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about welfare reform, and we have a couple of people who are waiting here with comments, so let's go on and go to the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yes.
I just have a little comment, and maybe you got a couple of answers. I just one thing that enters into this poverty picture that I think is a big concern, and that's where how many people a year or a month or something come into the United States as like Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and so forth at a low income, at an unskilled, at an undereducated worker that comes in, that comes onto our poverty rolls, which counts as form of poverty. And that I read the figures, and I can't find them back as to what that figure is, but it's an enormous amount of folks that come in, and I guess they're sort of welcome here, but then they end up as our low-income people. It makes it sound like that our poverty people are increasing, but a lot of them are kind of happy with the income that we have here on poverty, I think.
Mm-hmm. No, you put your finger on, I think, an emerging question in terms of social science. Everyone is now recognizing that a lot of the political railing that we hear about how the poor got poorer and the rich got richer, which isn't even necessarily true, but a substantial amount of that is due to the fact that we, unlike almost any other country in the world today, have a huge number of incoming low-skilled immigrants who are quite happy to take low-wage jobs in our economy. But that creates an impression of increasing inequality and also, in some cases, increasing poverty. These individuals, even if they're illegal immigrants, are in fact showing up in the census poverty count and in the census count of income equality, and that's a very, very important factor. Other people also feel that one of the things that's going on is that many of these immigrants are displacing Americans, particularly American black workers, from some of these low-wage jobs that the black workers need to have. That's a little bit more debatable, but it is certainly a problem that needs to be thought about and discussed.
That was just my comment.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Answers.
Let us go on. We'll go to someone on line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just had a couple questions for you. Since child care is a major reason why single moms really need welfare, is there a program that will be in place for the women who are required to do community service while they're getting welfare? That's question number one. And number two is, which major political party is closest to this philosophy of welfare reform? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
In the specifics of my proposal, I would start by taking the half of the welfare mothers who currently do not have preschool children and asking them to perform community service first. That would be a dramatic change in the welfare system. It would take several years to implement that. And then after we'd seen what happened there, then we could talk about requiring the same thing from mothers that have preschool children. You would also put another requirement on that if the mother stayed on welfare for, say, over 4 years, she couldn't just continue to have one child after another and defer her work obligation. But by and large, I think we could do a whole lot to transform the welfare system without talking about the mothers that have preschool kids. Let's focus on the easy part of the population to begin with. One thing that the general public doesn't understand, because there is a lot of rhetoric about, oh, we're going to make welfare recipients work, we're going to make them do this, that basically that is misleading rhetoric. That in Illinois or in the average state today, as we're talking here this afternoon on the radio, almost certainly no more than about 6% of all the mothers that are on welfare are actively participating in a job search program, and probably no more than 1% are actively participating in this type of community service that I'm talking about. So there's a tremendous opportunity out there to dramatically expand the amount of required work in every single state without, in fact, touching mothers that have preschool kids. And my policy that I've advocated in Washington is to start with those mothers that have older children first. They have less, first of all, they're not going to need all that daycare assistance, except perhaps in the summer when the child isn't in school. And they have less justification for being at home with the child. So that's where I would begin. I've been in this field for 15 years, and basically I've not seen
many, if I've very, very seldom seen any welfare mothers required to do anything. So I would be very happy if we could just say to all the welfare mothers that don't have preschool children, we're going to require them to work first, and then we'll talk about those that have the younger kids.
Where will the money come from to pay these people for their work? Are you expecting states are going to do that, or what?
No. What I'm saying is that the average mother on welfare is getting about $14,000 a year nationwide.
Uh-huh.
In some states, it's lower, and the payment varies within the state. But basically, they're getting enough so that you could say to the mother, all right, we're already giving you $10,000 to $14,000 a year in welfare benefits. In exchange for what we're already giving you, we will expect you to perform some form of community service or to get a private sector job. If you get a private sector job, you're going to be off the welfare rolls. But if you can't find a private sector job, then we're going to expect you to work in a hospital, to do neighborhood cleanup, to do clerical work in nonprofit organizations around the community. You're going to perform that community service, and in effect, your rate of pay will be the welfare benefits that we're already giving you.
No.
So it's not a system that would cost any additional money. And in fact, because I believe that if you did this, even just restricting it to the mothers that do not have preschool children, that it would cause as many as 1 million mothers to, in fact, get off of welfare and either get a job or get married, that it would, in fact, have a dramatic effect of saving money. But that isn't my principal objective.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We are coming down to about our last 5 minutes and have a couple of callers. I want to try and include at least one of them. Let's go again to our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Well, in case your guest hasn't been reading the latest statistics from the U.S. government, we have 2 million more people that have, according to their calculations, have fallen below the poverty level. So the situation is actually getting worse. The gap is widening between rich, in quotation marks, and poor, in quotation marks, both in the richer industrialized countries and in the rest of the world, the third world. And I don't think that we can really solve the problem until we get at the root of the system, the market economy that we have. And I would think that the people who are in the higher circles of finance and capital and in the government also would want to solve this problem, because it destabilizes capitalism as we have it at the present time. It's a destabilizing factor. It was a very important factor in the recent big riots this spring in Los Angeles. It was mainly poor people rioting out there. As you're aware, and going back to Watts and so forth, you know, in the 60s. So it's a very serious problem, and nobody wants to address it. They want the misery to continue, and now we're getting to 9-10% unemployment.
I'm not saying that there are not problems in our economy, and clearly the fact that we're in a prolonged recession has thrown a lot of people out of work, and it's made more poor people. It's reduced average family income. But what you have to be aware of is that those statistics, which list the number of poor people in the United States, have what in my mind are two rather large flaws in them. One is that in defining a poor person, they don't count any assets. So that in fact 40% of all poor people, as listed by the Census Bureau, in fact own their own homes. The second more important flaw in them is that out of the $226 billion that is being spent to assist poor people, the Census Bureau counts only about $30 billion of that as income. So that when it defines a poor person, it says, do you have an income below your family of four? Do you have an income below $14,000 a year? When it goes to count the family's income, it automatically excludes food stamps. It automatically excludes public housing assistance. It automatically excludes a tremendous amount of cash assistance. In fact, the entire increase in the welfare state, which has occurred since 1964, is not counted by the Census Bureau. It's as if we spent all this money, but it didn't have any effect on people's standard of living, when in fact it really did. Poor people's standard of living is in fact much higher than it was in 1965. And that is why I say that I think that when you really look below the surface of those figures at the actual housing conditions and food consumption and so forth of low-income Americans, you find that it's much better than you would imagine. And that I think that, that a sort of false and exaggerated picture of material poverty is in fact actually harmful, because it distracts our attention from these more important problems of behavioral poverty and how to reform the welfare system to address those behavioral poverty problems.
Some people, I'd say, though, might counter that your discussion about the material well-being of people in this country, people who are classified as poor, in a sense, is misleading. One has to ask what really is the value of the assets that you're talking about, and what really does that mean? For example, if someone does own a house, you have to ask what's the value of the house, and you wouldn't really expect...
The value of the house, on average, is about two-thirds of the value of the average house in the United States. The average house owned by a poor person is a three-bedroom house with a garage and a porch or a patio. These people are not affluent by any stretch of the imagination, but they're also not really poor in the sense that the ordinary people have a picture of poverty in the United States. And I think that by exaggerating the extent of material poverty, by claiming that there are in fact millions of malnourished children, when in fact the government surveys by the Centers for Disease Control and Department of Agriculture and HHS have shown for over 20 years that that is not the case, that these kids in fact are not malnourished, they're supernourished by most historic standards, only gets in the way of the discussion of these much more important problems such as family breakup. When you deprive, the poor children today are not malnourished. They are living in homes without fathers. And kids who are raised in homes without fathers have just tremendous multiple problems. A young black man who's raised without a father, when compared to a black man in exactly the same neighborhood, exactly the same income level, everything else held constant, that young black man that is deprived of a father figure while he's growing up is twice as likely to get caught up in criminal activity and end up in jail. That's a real human tragedy. That's a real problem that's facing us today. And by creating bogus claims that there's widespread malnutrition, that we need to spend more on conventional welfare programs, we're only really harming the poor by distracting the discussion from the real problems that are facing us.